Today you'll hear the speech given by Canadian professor Graham McQueen at the conference in Kuala Lumpur in November of 2012 called 9/11 Revisited, Seeking the Truth. Graham McQueen has been actively involved in 9/11 research for many years and was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings that took place on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 in September 2011. The speech you're about to hear was recorded live, and I want to apologize in advance for some of the imperfections in the sound quality that I was unable to edit out. So here he is, Dr. Graham McQueen, talking about anthrax and 9/11.
I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to your wonderful city, my first time here. I want to thank Dr. Mahathir Mohamad for having the courage to raise this issue publicly. I know of no leader in the West who has had that courage. I want to thank the Perdana Global Peace Foundation not only for putting on this event, but for its ongoing efforts to criminalize war. Now, with that, I would like to begin. As far as we can tell, deception has always been a part of war. Chinese thinker Sun Tzu put it succinctly in his work, The Art of War, which he composed during China's Warring States period about 2,500 years ago. War, he said, is the art of deception. In the 21st century, deception is needed not simply for winning this or that military engagement, but for the preservation of the institution of war itself. War is widely loathed, hated in global society. And we have today international institutions that have the potential to relegate war to the human past. How is it that this ancient and brutal institution raises its head again? The answer is because of deception. When the Cold War ended, a new global conflict formation was put in place called the Global War on Terror, and in my view, it is thoroughly based on deception. If we care about the well-being of the world's peoples, we must do our best to expose this deception. When we do so, we are placing ourselves within the historic movement for the criminalization and banning of war. I've given today's presentation the title, Fall 2001, The Message, The Terrorists. I want to raise two main questions. What's the message of the terrorists who carried out attacks in the United States in the fall of 2001? And secondly, who are these terrorists? I want to address these questions by dealing briefly with two sets of events that took place in the United States in the fall of 2001, and I believe these two sets of events are connected, even though today we tend to be encouraged to disconnect them. The first set of attacks on civilians occurred on September 11th, the so-called 9/11 attacks that you know about. The second set of attacks are in some sense less worrisome because the casualties were far fewer. In another sense, they are more worrisome because they involve a weapon of mass destruction. How many of you remember that in the fall of 2001, the United States was attacked with a weapon of mass destruction? I am speaking, of course, of the anthrax attacks, which began a week after 9/11, and I'm going to talk about the anthrax attacks for the first half of this presentation. Let me remind you what they were. Beginning in September 18th, letters containing spores of Bacillus anthracis, anthrax, were sent through the U.S. mail system to prominent people in the mass media and to two Democratic senators. The spores had been prepared in a sophisticated way to increase their lethality. In other words, they had been weaponized, and that means this was a biological weapon, and that means it was a weapon of mass destruction. At least seven letters with anthrax were mailed. In the attacks on the senators, each letter contained about 2 grams of anthrax with approximately 1 trillion spores per gram. Robert Stevens died of inhalational anthrax on October 5th, 2001. He was the first of 5 people murdered with this weapon. 22 others were injured. The first military strike on Afghanistan took place 2 days after Stephen's death. And during October, as the anthrax scare intensified and the attack on Afghanistan escalated, the USA Patriot Act was making its way through Congress, being signed into law on October 26th after two Democratic senators in a position to obstruct its passage were targeted with anthrax letters. The anthrax attacks were widely reported in the United States and were widely seen as the second blow by the same perpetrators who carried out 9/11, not surprisingly. There is no doubt that the anthrax attack contributed to the atmosphere of fear, and fear is our theme in this session, which facilitated military invasions beginning with Afghanistan and continuing to this day, as well as the restriction of civil rights in the United States and other Western countries, including my own, Canada. Now let us consider briefly my two questions. What was the message of the anthrax terrorists, and who were the anthrax terrorists? The anthrax sent to Senators Daschle and Leahy was, fortunately for us, accompanied by text, that is, by actual letters. If we read those letters, we may be able to determine what the message was. These letters are crude and brief, but in my opinion, they are among the most important documents of the 21st century. Please look at them with me. First, date at the top, then this is next. Take penicillin now. Penicillin spelt wrong. Death to America, death to Israel. Allah is great. You see how crude the English of Muslims is. Letter number two, and this I would really put as one of the most important documents, not only for this session, but of the 21st century. You cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Listen to the taunt to the American population. Are you afraid? Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great. Well, I would summarize the four main points implied in these letters as follows. One, we are Muslims. Two, we are cruel and violent. Three, we intend to kill you. And number four, we are connected to those who carried out the 9/11 attacks. Look at the date at the top in both of these letters. Not only what is the date, but look at how it is written, 9/11/01. Now, if the word terrorism has any legitimate meaning, this message, accompanied by lethal anthrax spores, is certainly a terrorist message. It credibly threatens violence against civilians. This was not a surprising message. Most of the media in the United States and most political analysts took this link for granted. Of course, this is the second blow by the same people. A group of Muslim extremists, such as Al-Qaeda, was clearly the immediate perpetrator. This hypothesis seemed to fit with the crude English and the primitive method of delivering the anthrax by just putting letters in the mail. But if the English was crude and the means of delivering the anthrax was primitive, what about the anthrax spores in the letters? There was nothing crude about the spores. According to several scientific groups, the anthrax sent, especially that sent to the senators, was one of the most sophisticated preparations of aerosolized anthrax ever seen. So we have crude little letters sent through the mail, and we have this extremely sophisticated anthrax, and it creates a tension in our mind. What's going on? One answer to this dilemma was quickly proposed. While Al-Qaeda may have delivered the anthrax itself must have come from a state source. Guess what that state source was? Iraq, we were told. So here is the theory that emerged. Al-Qaeda, the immediate perpetrator, but behind Al-Qaeda lurks Iraq. And this was the story that was pounded into Americans throughout October by the mass media in the United States. Here, for example, is what the Wall Street Journal had to say in an article about the anthrax attacks published on October 15, 2001. Quote, Several circumstantial links to Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network are already known, but bin Laden couldn't be doing all this in Afghan caves. The leading supplier suspect has to be Iraq. Just when the campaign against Iraq was fully getting off the ground in October, however, a problem arose. Some of the scientists who examined the anthrax in effect blew the whistle. They said there was no evidence that Iraq or Al-Qaeda had ever gotten a hold of the particular strain of anthrax used. It's called the Ames strain. It was discovered in the wild in the United States. It was cultivated and kept within highly secure laboratories in the United States, shared with a few allies, not shared certainly with Iraq or with Al-Qaeda. Nor was the method of weaponizing the anthrax characteristic of the method used by Iraq, despite the repeated claims of ABC News to the contrary. On the contrary, the method of preparation was closer to U.S. methods than Iraqi methods. This story about Al-Qaeda and Iraq fell apart with remarkable rapidity. By January 2002, Tom Ridge of the recently formed Department of Homeland Security made the acknowledgement public. It appears, he says, that the anthrax in the letters came from a domestic source. What does this mean? You cannot buy this stuff in a drugstore. What Ridge was actually acknowledging was that since the anthrax came from highly secure laboratories serving the U.S. military and intelligence communities, the attacks must have been carried out by, or at least with the assistance of, insiders within these communities. The FBI accepted this conclusion, and it has seldom been challenged since. I'm giving you this because the official story now by the FBI is that this was an inside job. Who then were the terrorists? As it went on the hunt, the FBI began with a strange procedure. It decided that if this was an inside job, it must have been carried out by an individual rather than a group, preferably a mentally unbalanced individual. This is the famous lone nut hypothesis, commonly used in the United States to keep us from asking embarrassing questions. The lone nut eventually elected to fill this position was Bruce Ivins. Dr. Ivins had been working on an anthrax vaccine at the U.S. Army Military Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland. He died, allegedly of a self-administered overdose of Tylenol, a week before being charged with the crime. Therefore, no legal proceeding ever took place. Had it done so, he surely would have been let go, given the nature of the evidence. I have carefully studied the report by the U.S. Department of Justice in which the case against Ivan is made. You can read it yourself. It is found on the internet. My own conclusion is that Dr. Ivins had nothing to do with this crime. In any case, the most important claim the FBI made, namely that the anthrax in a flax under Ivan's supervision was the parent material for the spores in the letters, has been undercut by a study by the National Research Council in the United States. In a report published in 2011, this group said the FBI's confidence in its scientific methods in linking Ivan's flask to the spores was not justified. In effect, this critique leaves the FBI's case against Ivan's in ruins. I don't have time to develop the argument today about who really did the anthrax attacks and about the links between the anthrax attacks and the 9/11 attacks, although that is a fascinating topic. I have brought up the anthrax attacks today simply to open your minds to a dissenting view of 9/11. My own study shows that these anthrax attacks were not carried out by any individual, mentally unbalanced or otherwise. They were carried out by a group. This group was not mentally unbalanced. It was sane, it was rational, and it nested and still nests in the heart of the U.S. military and intelligence communities. Therefore, if I may sum up this part of my talk, we know, I believe, that beginning 1 week after 9/11, insiders in the military and intelligence communities of the United States collaborated in killing U.S. citizens, in targeting two U.S. senators, in terrorizing their own nation, and in framing Muslims, who, it turns out, had nothing to do with those absurd letters. Now let us move to 9/11. We have 11 years of research on 9/11. We have many critiques of the official story. I myself am involved in about three major initiatives to sort through the evidence and find the best. I'm not going to talk about them at length, but they're listed in my bio there. The 9/11 Consensus Panel, the Toronto Hearings on 9/11, and the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And you can find all three of these on the internet. In the meantime, however, my time is short. Let me briefly ask the two same questions I asked about the anthrax attacks. What is the message of the 9/11 terrorists, and who are those terrorists? In the case of 9/11, we weren't sent a letter, as we were in the anthrax case, so we need to be able to interpret the lethal theater, the dramatic actions of the attacks themselves.
You're about to hear the World Trade Center South Tower coming down. This is the actual audio, and you can time it. It takes approximately 11 seconds for this entire building to collapse. Imagine this whole 110-story building collapsing in just 11 seconds. And here it is.
North Tower has already been struck. Okay, the paradigmatic event. If you had been standing underneath the tower at the time that that happened, you would be a traumatized person. But what else could you say? You could say you were in the presence of extreme violence, but you would have no narrative. You wouldn't know who did it, how they did it, or anything else. In order to know that, you needed to be guided in your interpretation by media personalities and by political leaders, and that began on 9/11 itself. We were told these planes were hijacked, probably by people in bin Laden's organization. We were told the hijackers took over the planes and flew them themselves into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon as a form of suicide attack. Now, you must realize that U.S. citizens were already prepared over a period of years by their media to interpret the events in the sky as an attack by Muslims. Both airplane hijacking and suicide attacks were already associated in their minds with Muslims. You may protest that this is an oversimplification of history, and you would be right, but it is also irrelevant. What matters here is what the beliefs were in the minds of American citizens. The beliefs were that these were uniquely Muslim forms of activity. Therefore, the message required no letter. The message was written across the sky and transmitted by television into every living room in the United States, and that message was, we are Muslims, we are cruel and violent, and we intend to kill you. And that is the message that lies at the heart of the global war on terror and the demonization of Islam. And now I proceed to the second and more difficult question, which my colleagues a little bit earlier went into in more detail than I'm going to be able to do. Who are these terrorists? I want, rather than trying to give a lot of detailed information, to simply say to you, how do we proceed when we want to answer that question? And I want to emphasize that our conclusions must not be based on ideology, prejudice, or belief. They must be based on evidence. Evidence. That's what many of us have been trying day after day for years to gather and to sort through. If we are wrong, we stand ready to be corrected, but we cannot be shown to be wrong through ridicule, moral outrage, or arguments from authority. We must be shown to be wrong through evidence. I believe the evidence we have gathered over 11 years is strong in both quality and quantity. And I believe that one set of evidence strongly corroborates another set of evidence. And really, in my remaining moments, I want to give you an example of that by concentrating on one form of evidence that Richard Gage mentioned in his presentation, the eyewitness evidence the eyewitnesses at the World Trade Center who say they perceived these towers being torn apart by explosions. Bear in mind, please, that the official account has no room for such explosions. If these explosions took place and were indeed the result of planned explosive demolition, the official count of 9/11 is finished. Hence the importance of this evidence. Now I'm going to show you two brief video clips to show you what I mean by detailed corroboration. First, however, this little graph of 156 eyewitnesses. I have personally gathered together 156 accounts, previously 118, now expanded to 156, and have published 118 of them. Hopefully the 156 will be published soon. I want to assure you that I used careful methods in compiling this list. If somebody says they heard a big boom in the World Trade Center, that's not enough to get on my list. If they say they heard an explosion, it gets on the list. They must use certain terms in order to get on here. We have 156 eyewitnesses, and this is not even a comprehensive count. What I'm saying is, in a general sense, we have a great deal of corroboration here. But let's look at a specific case. This first clip was shown to you by Richard, and I'm going to look at it again.
We made it outside. We made it about a block.
We made it at least two blocks, and we started running. Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like, it was if it had detonated.
Detonated.
If they were planned to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
All the way down. I was watching it and running.
Just ran up west.
And then you just...
Okay, what do we see? First of all, we hear two firefighters, Pat Zoda and Dennis Tardio of the Fire Department of New York, corroborating each other's testimony, nodding, saying, yes, that's what we saw. Yes, we were looking directly at the towers. They not only do that, but they give a particular hand gesture. Starts with Pat Zoda, confirmed by Dennis Tardio, and this is what they say. Zoda, floor by floor it started popping out. Tardio, it was as if they had detonated. Detonated, you know, as if they were planted to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom. Confirmed by Zoda, yeah. Now, my question is, they are corroborating each other, but is there anyone else who is completely independent from these witnesses who gives a detailed confirmation, a detailed corroboration of this? And there are many. I don't have time to read them all, but here's an example. This fellow is Paul Lemos. On 9/11, he was in the vicinity of the World Trade Center participating in the filming of a commercial. He was interviewed on videotape on 9/11 near World Trade Center. You can actually see World Trade Center 7 in the background when he's talking. So it's obviously before 5:20 in the afternoon. Here's what's important. He was filmed by a different filmmaker, a different time, different location from the firefighters, and this is entirely independent testimony. Now I want you to listen to what he says about what he saw and to look at his gestures when he describes it. Just like the two firefighters, he is talking about the destruction of the North Tower, World Trade Center 1.
Can you tell us your name?
My name's Paul Lemos. All of a sudden, I looked up, and about 20 stories below, at least that's what it looked like to me, about 75 flights up below the fire, I saw from the corner, boom, 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 boom. Just like 20 straight hits just went down, and then I just saw the whole building just went... And as the bombs were going, people just started running, and I sat there and watched a few of them explode, and then I just turned around, and I just started running for my life, because at that point, World Trade Center was coming right down, right above us.
We see the same hand gesture, a series of little karate chops, which clearly indicate separate energetic bursts starting near the top and coming down at systematically at regular intervals. And we hear the words. All of a sudden, I looked up, and about 20 stories below the fire, I saw from the corner, boom, 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 just like 20 straight hits, just went down, and then I just saw the whole building just went, pshhh. And as the bombs, he does not hesitate to use the word, were gone, people started running, and I sat there and watched a few of them explode, and then I just turned around and I started running for my life, because at that point, the World Trade Center was coming right down. My friends, this is what we mean by corroboration. These are very rich eyewitness accounts. And we have many, many others, as I've said. Now, I'm aware that my time is running out, so let me go on to say this. On what basis can I, as a researcher, reject what Pat Zoda and Dennis Tardio and Paul Lemos have said? On what basis can I reject the accounts of the other 153 witnesses? They were there, I wasn't. What should I think when I discovered that both the 9/11 Commission and the National Institute of Technology in their reports have somehow missed all 156 eyewitnesses? What should I conclude when I discover that these eyewitness accounts are further corroborated, as Mr. Gage has shown, by entirely different kinds of evidence, evidence of extremely high temperatures, of explosive residue, and so on? What should I do when proponents of the official account tell me to accept violations of the laws of physics? Surely in such a case, I have to say, however distressing the implications, I must honor this evidence and I must insist on a thorough investigation of these incidents, which is precisely what I do insist on. It seems to me that a great and grievous deception took place on 9/11. As we work to uncover this deception, and I will be concluding with this, I suggest we keep in mind UN Security Council Resolution 1368, which was passed by the Security Council on September 12, 2001, the day after these attacks. I'm sure many of you know this resolution was used by the party of war to legitimize the invasion of Afghanistan. It's time the party of peace used it for a different purpose. The resolution says that the Security Council unequivocally condemns in the strongest terms the horrifying terrorist attacks which took place on 11 September 2001, and it goes on to say that the Security Council calls on all states to work together urgently to bring to justice the perpetrators, organizers, and sponsors of these terrorist attacks, and stresses that those responsible for aiding, supporting, or harboring the perpetrators, organizers, and sponsors of these attacks will be held accountable. And that is what we're trying to do. Thank you.
And again, that was Canadian Professor Graham McQueen at the 9/11 conference in Kuala Lumpur in November of 2012. To see the video of this speech or others from the conference, you can go to YouTube and search for 9/11 and Kuala Lumpur. As I may have mentioned in a previous show, in the fall, the Colorado PBS station aired the latest movie by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth called Experts Speak Out. It was the most watched video for a long time after it was aired and posted on the National Public Television website. Now, Experts Speak Out is being shown by the North Carolina public TV station. And I understand that Architects and Engineers is talking to other states to do the same. So the scientific evidence that shows that the official story of 9/11 can't possibly be true is reaching a wider and wider audience. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.